This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We want to get to know our new poet laureate, Robert Pinsky, so we invited him to join us to read some of his poems and some of his favorites by other poets. Pinsky was appointed last spring and gives his inaugural lecture October 9th. A couple of years ago, he was on the bestseller list for his translation of Dante's Inferno, the 14th century poet's vision of hell. But you can't accuse Pinsky of being stuck in the past. He's also poetry editor of the online magazine Slate. Pinsky's own collection of poems from 1966 to 96, called The Figured Wheel, was published in paperback this year. Pinsky is 56, grew up in New Jersey, and teaches in the graduate program of Boston University. I asked him first to describe a project he's getting underway that he's very excited about. It's called the Favorite Poem Project.
I hope that we'll be able to make an audio and video record of many Americans saying aloud a poem that that person loves. I think there's a special physical and emotional pleasure people get when they say lines they really like aloud. And I hope we'll get a very wide range of regional accents, ages, kinds of education. And I hope maybe 10 or 15% will be eminent Americans. I'd like to ask the president, ask Senator Helms, and make a kind of record of what Americans choose and what we do with our faces and our voices when we read aloud a poem.
What do you mean, what we do with our faces and our voices?
Well, I think that the way a person reads a poem aloud, apart from the skill of the actor or of the poet who's become polished on the platform, I think the way a person reads aloud something that has created a strong attachment to those exact words is very powerful. Even if the performance isn't skillful by those other standards, it generates something very deep and goes back very far in human history.
I love the idea of this project. I'm cynical about just one thing. I'm skeptical that if you ask a president or any high elected official to recite a favorite poem, that they'll go to their aide and say, what poem can I recite that would be very impressive?
I think it's good. I think that if it means that the congressman or senator or official in question says to the aides, find me a favorite poem, good. That in itself is a good step. And I think some people will surprise you. Senator John Kerry quoted Shelley to me by memory. And he volunteered to read all of the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock to me. He knows poetry. I'm sure there are many people. I think there are more people, not only in Washington, but in the country generally, there are more people than might be thought, who are deeply attached to certain poems.
If I asked you right now to quote something from memory that means a lot to you, not one of your own, what would it be?
Once out of nature, I shall never take my bodily form from any natural thing, but such a form as Grecian goldsmiths make of hammered gold and gold enameling, and set upon a golden bough to keep the drowsy emperor awake, or sing to lords and ladies of Byzantium of what is past or passing or to come. Now, if I misquoted it, that's only natural.
And tell us about the poem it's from.
Oh, it's Sailing to Byzantium by William Butler Yeats, which it's a poem when I was about 17 years old. It's the poem that it really fulfilled the expression, blew my mind for me. I read it in school, and I can remember typing the poem up and putting it on the wall in the kitchen where I ate breakfast so I could stare at it and think, how did he do that? It's very much a poem about art and the art of poetry.
Is there a couple of lines that epitomize to you what makes this poem so extraordinary in terms of the language?
Well, two lines, not from the part I quoted, but earlier in the poem. They're two lines that have become a kind of credo for me in my profession. He says, "Nor is there singing school, but studying monuments of its own magnificence." That is, there's no way to study singing except studying monumental examples of singing's magnificence. That in whatever pursuit, whether it's playing the saxophone or poetry or whatever, the way to learn is to study the very greatest, to study, not just notice, but to study great, monumental, magnificent examples. I read it when I was 17, and it had conviction for me, and I think I believe it more than ever.
So you've devoted your life to both studying poetry and writing it?
Same activity.
Some people find...
Ezra Pound says he says that the highest form of criticism is actual composition. And when you're playing your music or you're writing your poem, you are choosing every second what to do. And in that sense, you're studying.
That's nice. You know, some people find it so intimidating to be constantly immersed in the greatest writing or the greatest music and then to write or play their own because it can never measure up. Sometimes your critical faculties are so far beyond what you're capable of producing yourself.
That makes sense, but it's not my experience. My experience, for example, when I used to try to play tennis, if I watched really great players play, it made me itch to play. When I read something like Yeats, or William Carlos Williams or Bishop, it makes me want to write. It's mediocre horn playing or tennis playing or poetry, reading something in a magazine that I don't think is very good, that makes me despair. It makes me think, why bother to write poems? Things that are great, it would make sense that they would make you not want to work, but I find the opposite. I think they inspire you. Art comes from art.
My guest is our new poet laureate, Robert Pinsky. You have a poem I'd like you to read for us, and it's called If You Could Write One Great Poem, What Would You Want It to Be About? And there's a story behind this poem that I would like you to tell us first.
I was poet in residence in a rural area of Illinois in a program that sent writers to parts of the country where there are no writers. And I went to the prison, community college, colleges, and I went to the schools for the deaf and the blind, and I did a teaching day with one of those teachers, a really great teacher. And this is a poem at the end of the day. Mostly what I did is I just listened to the kids, these are mostly blind kids, read their poems, say their poems aloud, and we talked about them. And at one point it occurred to me to ask them that question in chatting with them. If you could write one poem that would be really great, that everyone would recognize as great and you would know was terrific, what would you want the subject to be? And the four students I quote in the poem did give interesting answers. And this one young woman who was partially deaf as well as partially blind gave a very striking answer, and her answer sort of takes over the poem. It's only an 8-line poem.
Read it for us.
If you could write one great poem, what would you want it to be about? Asked of four student poets at the Illinois schools for the deaf and the visually impaired. Fire, because it is quick and can destroy. Music, place where anger has its place. Romantic love, the cold or stupid, ask why. Sign. That it is a language full of grace, that it is visible, invisible, dark and clear, that it is loud and noiseless and is contained inside a body and explodes in air out of a body to conquer from the mind.
Is that last part the quote of one student?
She said that, well, I've changed the words a little. I made it rhyme. But she said that if she could write a great poem, she would want it to be about sign. And I said, why? She said, I would want to say that it is a real language. And I guess I elaborated on that.
Oh, that's great. I like the way you read that poem. I know some poets seem very uncomfortable when they're reading. They read in a monotone that seems unworthy of the coloring and emotion in the actual poem. Were you ever shy about reading? Was it hard for you to read with the expression and rhythm that you wanted to have?
To take the first part of what you said first, I think it would be too bad if we generated the idea that introverts can't be poets. Only people with very forceful personalities and certain kind of voices could be poets. You know, William Carlos Williams had a kind of funny voice, and I'm not sure Emily Dickinson would have been a hit on the poetry reading circuit. You write for the voice and with your voice, but though a vocal art, it's not a performative art, in my opinion. I mean, once you're reading aloud, it's better not to bore people. But I'd be slow to condemn poets reading in a way that's not immediately pleasing in a performing way.
That said, I'm wondering what you think of the whole performance poetry popularity now, where a lot of it really is more about the drama and energy of the person's performance than it is about, say, the words on the page.
I'm not against it, but for me, the most profound, the deepest, and oldest aspect of poetry is that it is a physical, bodily art in which the medium is the audience's body. It's anyone saying the poem aloud. For me, the deepest and most penetrating part of poetry is not hearing a great actor or a poet with an impressive appearance or a wonderful skill reading aloud. It's when someone has a poem by heart or is deeply attached to a poem and says those words, drawing that comfort that goes so far back in our history as a creature, as an animal. That's the deepest aspect of it for me.
My guest is America's new poet laureate, Robert Pinsky. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is our new poet laureate, Robert Pinsky. I've asked you to bring with you some of your own poems to read for us and some favorite poems by others that you'd like to read for us. And I'd like to ask you to read one of the poems you brought with you, this one by Robert Frost. Tell us why you've chosen to read this one.
I think it just sounds ravishing. It's like your favorite Coltrane record or your favorite Schnabel performance. I think it just sounds great as a poem. And I guess I also like the way it's about, I'm not in my first blush of youth, I like the way the poem is about a sensibility that both changes over a long time and in other ways stays the same.
You want to read it?
To Earthward. Love at the lips was touch as sweet as I could bear. And once that seemed too much, I lived on air that crossed me from sweet things, the flow of, was it musk from hidden grapevine springs downhill at dusk? I had the swirl and ache from sprays of honeysuckle that when they're gathered shake dew on the knuckle. I craved strong sweets, but those seemed strong when I was young. The petal of the rose it was that stung. Now, no joy but lacks salt that is not dashed with pain and weariness and fault. I crave the stain of tears, the aftermark of almost too much love, the sweet of bitter bark and burning clove. When stiff and sore and scarred, I take away my hand from leaning on it hard in grass and sand. The hurt is not enough. I long for weight and strength to feel the earth as rough to all my length.
That's really wonderful. Now, that's got a rhyme scheme to it. And I'm wondering if you've gone through different periods in your life, in your relationship to rhyme, liking it, disdaining it.
To me, it's just another instrument in the orchestra, so to speak. And mm-hmm. to me, it also, it's not either rhyme or not rhyme. Rhyme comes in degrees. All sounds have some degree of similarity and some degree of likeness. And whether you're writing a poem in so-called free verse or in iambs or in rhyme, you're thinking about how much one word sounds like the one next to it or doesn't, or the one 10 words before. It's just part of the nature of the medium.
Now, since we're talking about rhyme and about reading out loud, talk to me a little bit about reading that poem so that the rhyme doesn't become sing-song, so that the rhyme sounds but isn't made too much of?
When the grammar keeps going at the end of a line, your voice should keep going. When the grammar stops at the end of the line, then your voice stops.
Maybe you can give an
Let's
example.
Let's take an example.
Yeah, good. Yeah. There we go.
If I say, I had the swirl and ache from sprays of honeysuckle, the when they're gathered shake dew on the knuckle, Nobody misses the rhymes. You hear it, and I had the swirling ache from sprays of honeysuckle that when they're gathered shake dew on the knuckle. And part of the pleasure is hearing that sentence snake through the rhymes and reach to where it's going. If you say, I had the swirling ache from sprays of honeysuckle that when they're gathered shake dew on the knuckle, that's what killed poetry.
Yeah.
that's not... that killed rhyme, you know.
So
I think it's probably the most important advice I could give anybody about poetry is when the sentence keeps going, your voice should keep going.
Now, you had to do a lot of intricate rhyming yourself when you translated Dante's Inferno, and that actually became a bestseller in 1994, I think shocking everybody. But there's a very intricate rhyme scheme that you had to maintain there. What was the rhyme scheme?
It's called terza rima, and Dante invented it for the Commedia. It didn't even exist before. And it's these three-line stanzas where the outside two, the first and third lines, rhyme. And then the middle line tells you what the outside rhyme is going to be for the next stanza. And it's good for a narrative, as he was writing, because everything is kind of linked. But it can still sound quite musical and even kind of clinching like couplets.
Would you recite a passage from your translation?
Okay. From memory. Day was departing, and the darkening air called all Earth's creatures to their evening quiet, while I alone was preparing as though for war to struggle with my journey and with the spirit of pity which flawless memory will redraw. O muses, O genius of art, O memory whose merit has inscribed inwardly those things I saw, help me fulfill the perfection of your nature.
Like that. let me ask you, when you're dealing with rhyme, how much are you willing to deal with something more like harmony rather than rhyme exactly?
That's it. That's what you do. As I say, thinking about end rhyme isn't the only thing. There's a wonderful sentence in Frost's unrhymed poem, An Old Man's Winter Night, where he says, a light it was to no one but himself where now he sat, a quiet light, and then not even that. Well, those T's go off beautifully. A light he was to no one but himself where now he sat, concerned with he knew what, a quiet light, and then not even that. And it's not in rhyme, they're not end rhymes. The what and the at and the quiet and the light.
Mm-hmm.
A light he was to know himself, no one but himself where now he sat, concerned with he knew what. A quiet light, and then not even that. Is that rhyme? I don't know. It's a degree of likeness that's very taking in the poem.
I think one of the great things about hearing poetry read out loud is that it's read at the right speed. I don't know, I'm such a kind of inveterate fast reader that sometimes I really lose out on poetry because I'm reading fast and you need to have the language sound. And if you're reading fast, it's just not going to happen.
I have a three-word cure.
Yeah.
Read it aloud.
Yeah, right, right.
Read it aloud.
Right.
That advice comes even before the other.
Mm-hmm.
Read it aloud.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it's not poetry.
While we're talking...
For me.
Yeah, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. While we're talking about rhyme, I want you to read a short poem of yours that has rhymes within, and it's called An Old Man. Can you talk with us before reading it about why you wanted this to rhyme?
Well, it's only sort of by me. It's based on my reading of translations of Constantine Cavafy's poem, An Old Man, a poem I loved in translation for many years, and I knew from reading the notes in the Sheridan Keeley and in the Ray Dalvin translations that it was in a very complicated rhyme scheme. And one day I got the notion I could do it. I call it An Old Man after Cavafy, and it's pretty close to what Cavafy wrote, but I can't read Greek. It's my poem based on the translations. I don't know whether to call it a translation or a poem. An Old Man after Cavafy. Back in a corner, alone in the clatter and babble, an old man sits with his head bent over a table and his newspaper in front of him in the cafe. Sour with old age, he ponders a dreary truth. How little he enjoyed the years when he had youth, good looks and strength and clever things to say. He knows he's quite old now. He feels it. He sees it. And yet the time when he was young seems, was it yesterday? How quickly it slipped away. Now he sees how discretion has betrayed him and how stupidly he let the liar persuade him with phrases. Tomorrow, there's plenty of time. Someday. He recalls the pull of impulses he suppressed, the joy he sacrificed. Every chance he lost ridicules his brainless prudence a different way. But all these thoughts and memories have made the old man dizzy. He falls asleep, his head resting on the table in the noisy cafe.
Robert Pinsky is America's new poet laureate. His latest book of poems, The Figured Wheel, collects his poems from the past 30 years. Pinsky will be back with us in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with America's new poet laureate, Robert Pinsky. He gives his inaugural lecture October 9th. A collection of his poems from the past 30 years has been published in paperback. It's called The Figured Wheel. When we left off, we were talking about rhyme schemes in poetry. Is there any rule against using a rhyme that somebody else has used? You know, sometimes you'll come across a rhyme and it's like really great. And does that mean you can absolutely never use it yourself?
Well, you know, English is this mongrel language. We have so many words and so many sounds because the island was invaded and people were raped and had their property taken away so many times. There's so many roots. And it doesn't have a lot of rhymes as a result because the words are from so many different directions. So it's pretty hard if you're going to rhyme truth with something. It's hard to avoid youth.
Right.
I think one of the pleasures of likeness in English sometimes is when roots come from different directions but kind of rhyme. I rhyme lost, which I'm guessing is a Anglo-Saxon word, with suppressed, which I'm guessing is a Latinate word, maybe not, but sacrificed, lost. Are those rhymes? Seem like rhymes to me.
You know, I never thought of it that way, that because English is made up of so many different languages or borrows from so many different languages, it's hard to rhyme.
That's why almost everything rhymes with everything else in Italian. I would imagine it's a terrible problem for an Italian or a Spanish poet, is that everything sounds kind of good. You know, if you said the bureaucrat puked on his computer, in Italian or Spanish, it sounds gorgeous.
So why Italian operas are so popular.
Oh, a terrible difficulty for the poets. I don't know how they put up with it.
Oh, that's funny. It seems to me that like rhyme is almost a generational thing, that some generations reject it and some really... just really find it enjoyable and pleasing. And I think we're definitely in a rhyming period now, in part because of rap.
Maybe so. You know, artists are always bad people to ask about trends.
Right.
Terry. Because we're trying to do...
What's the latest trend in poetry?
Yeah, I'm trying to avoid it.
Yeah,
I'm trying
exactly.
to do something nobody else is doing.
Uh-huh,
so in
uh-huh.
a way, I'm the last person to ask about something like that. And I never know... When I start thinking about trying to make a poem, I never know what technique it is or isn't going to use. It's like being in the middle of the ocean. You'll grab anything that floats by, you know.
Now, you brought a poem with you that you really love by a poet who I will confess I know nothing about. His name is Edward Arlington Robinson. Tell us a little bit about the poet and the poem.
An interesting fact about Robinson is that he's one of the rare beneficiaries of patronage. He was indigent, and one of Teddy Roosevelt's sons was reading a book of Robinson's and said, "Dad, this is really good." Teddy Roosevelt read it, thought it was really good, and he created a job in the Postal Service for Edwin Arlington Robinson. And when Robinson got to his desk, there was a note from the president saying, "Mr. Robinson, think poetry, not postage." And this poem is just, I think it's one of the most beautiful American poems. It's called Eros Tyrannos, Love the Tyrant or Love the King. And it's about a woman who has to choose whether she's going to have a love affair she knows will be a catastrophe, or no love affair at all. And she chooses the catastrophic love affair. And it's written in this talk about rhyme, this crazy sort of hyper ballad style, which becomes very appropriate as the her town speaks. You think it's a story about her and her lover, and then the town comments. So it's like a ballad that's being made by this little town. Eros Tyrannos. She fears him and will always ask what fated her to choose him. She meets in his engaging mask all reasons to refuse him. But what she meets and what she fears are less than are the downward years drawn slowly to the foamless weirs of age, were she to lose him. Between a blurred sagacity that once had power to sound him, and love that will not let him be the Judas that she found him, her pride assuages her almost, as if it were alone the cost. He sees that he will not be lost, and waits, and looks around him. A sense of ocean and old trees envelops and allures him. Tradition, touching all he sees, beguiles and reassures him. And all her doubts of what he says are dimmed with what she knows of days till even prejudice delays and fades, and she secures him. The falling leaf inaugurates the reign of her confusion. The pounding wave reverberates the dirge of her illusion. And home, where passion lived and died, becomes a place where she can hide while all the town and harbor side vibrate with her seclusion. We tell you, tapping on our brows, the story as it should be, as if the story of a house were told or ever could be. We'll have no kindly veil between her visions and those we have seen, as if we guessed what hers have been or what they are or would be. Meanwhile, we do no harm. For they that with a god have striven, not hearing much of what we say, take what the god has given, though like waves breaking it may be, or like a changed familiar tree, or like a stairway to the sea where down the blind are driven.
I think your comparison to a ballad is a perfect one.
Yes, and it's almost like I say hyper ballad because it's like a folk poem, but it's also aware of a tremendous distance between the folk tradition and him and his character.
Mm-hmm. Tell us what the town is saying at the end there.
I think they're saying we have a little more importance and dignity as a community because a kind of tragedy happened here. So that her story is elevated toward myth or tragedy by the community watching. And the community is elevated by the fact an extraordinary person wrestled with a god in that community.
How did you find this poem?
I can't remember. I know that whenever it was I read it, I remember thinking, she fears him. Damn, what a way to begin a poem. I want to do something like that. I often quote there's a Dexter Gordon album where the great saxophone player is asked, where do you get your inspiration? And the first two words he says are Lester Young. And then he talks about the Ellington Band and Billie Holiday. And things like Eros Tyrannos for title, and then she fears him. She fears him and will always ask what fated her to choose him. She meets in his engaging mask all reasons to refuse him. So many distinguished things and things that charm your ear are going on there. And it starts with those three monosyllables, that sentence, she fears him. I can't remember when I first read it, but I know when I saw that, it was like hearing some phrase or some harmony that, you know, you just want to hear again and again and think about.
Do we know what actually happens to her in this relationship?
He betrays her in some way. I don't think it is specified. there's a dirge of her illusion, and home where passion lived and died becomes a place where she can hide. And she knows he's a Judas from the beginning. So in my own imagining, where I start to wool gather away from the poem, she has an affair with him, and he exploits her sexually and maybe even financially, and then he vanishes, having gotten what he wants, and she then lives with the shame in the town. And she knew something of the kind was likely to happen. But she's wrestled with a god.
My guest is America's new poet laureate, Robert Pinsky. He'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Robert Pinsky is my guest. He's our new poet laureate. In college, I know this was true when I was in college anyways, that poetry seemed to be the pursuit of depressives. Poetry seemed to be about being sad, about being depressed. You were supposed to write it when you were feeling depressed, a kind of college person's blues. Did you go through that, like, depressive period of poetry?
That's a really great question. I've always been very attracted to the blues, partly because for a mediocre player like me, it's something you always can play. Maybe a similar principle applies in poetry. Never thought about it. I think that the physical expression of unhappiness is a great medicine. And both poetry and music can be physical, bodily ways to express what you're feeling. And for reasons I don't understand, there's a certain comfort or reassurance that comes out of doing that.
I'd love for you to read another one of your poems for us. Would you choose one?
American poets often fly around the place in airplanes, and probably many of us wind up writing a poem about what it's like to be up in an airplane. This is mine. You're looking down, you're landing, and you look down at the lights of a great city, and you're thinking every one of those lights has some kind of purpose and represents some human desire, if only the desire to have the UPS van know where to drive, or the desire to find a lover, or desire to write your book or watch TV or whatever. It's called Immortal Longings. Immortal longings. Inside the silver body, slowing as it banks through veils of cloud, we float separately in our seats, like the cells or atoms of one creature. Needs and states of a shuddering god. Under him, a thirsty brilliance, pulsing or steady, the fixed lights of the city and the flood of car lights coursing through the grid. Delivery, arrival, departure, whim, entering and entered, touching and touched. Down the lit boulevards, over the bridges and the river like an arm of night. Book, cigarette, bathroom, thirst. Some of us are asleep. We tilt roaring over the glittering zodiac of intentions.
That's wonderful.
Thanks.
Are you ever tempted in your books to give the kind of introduction to poems that you just gave us to this poem?
I suppose so. I suppose sometimes there's the temptation to want to set the stage a little bit. But there's also a pleasure. Sometimes at a poetry reading, I'll give myself the pleasure of not doing the poetry reading yak yak and just reading them one after, you know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
Just read them one after another. And I think that's closer to what the art is, because, you know, the art's not an art. It's not like a college board or something you'll be tested on. It's supposed to sound good. And if you don't get it all, well, most people's favorite music, opera or rock music, part of the charm is not getting the words the first 4 or 5 or 6 or 15 times you hear it. So that temptation is there, but it's a kind of cerebral temptation, I think.
I think you've also just answered an insecurity that some people have about poetry, which is, I don't know, I just don't understand it.
There are a lot of things people don't understand that they enjoy. sex comes to mind.
Oh, who can argue, huh?
What a nightmare. Imagine understanding it perfectly. What a nightmare.
Well, I can't think of a better note to end on. Robert Pinsky, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Robert Pinsky is America's new poet laureate. He gives his inaugural lecture October 9th. His collection of poems from the past 30 years is called The Figured Wheel.